Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a five-star review. All right, today we're going to be taking a deeper dive into the CAOA. So we are thrilled to have our expert on. He is the Director of Policy at the Liaison Group joining us today. Please welcome Mr. David Mangone.
Hi, Heather. Thanks. Thank you so much for having me on. As you said, I'm David Mangone, Director of Policy at the Liaison Group on Capitol Hill. We are a federal cannabis lobbying firm representing trade associations like the National Cannabis Roundtable, as well as the California Cannabis Industry Association and some other private clients. So I've been steeped in cannabis policy for about the last 6 years now, first at Americans for Safe Access and now at the Liaison Group working on the industry side. So happy to be here.
We're happy to have you. And as always, I am happy to welcome back Chief Knowledge Officer at New Frontier Data, Mr. John Cagilla. Welcome back.
Well, thanks very much, Heather. Delighted to be back.
Thank you. So, David, I know you just mentioned that you've been in the industry for about 6 years. What were you doing before that? What made you come into cannabis?
Sure. So before that, I was working on Capitol Hill for a senior Democratic member of the House Ways and Means Committee. He had retired with the change of the administration when President Trump came into office. So was looking for new career opportunities, saw something in cannabis, seemed really interesting just based on the portfolio I had covered on the Hill, had covered some veterans issues, particularly with Korean War, which is a little bit older of the demographic than you typically see entering into the cannabis space, but it also covered a lot of criminal justice issues as well. So saw an opportunity in cannabis, thought it was a really unique intersection of the issues I've been working on, and decided to give it a go. And 6 years later, which is a million years in the cannabis industry, here I am.
Well, that makes John, what, a million and one? Because you've been in it for eight.
It's crazy. I was actually, David, I remember when you joined the Liaison Group and Safira introduced you, the first time she introduced you is a new addition. And I can't believe that was 6 years ago. It both feels like it was yesterday and a lifetime ago.
That's right. You know, we'll take out the pandemic as a time loop. And so maybe it's a little bit shorter. Yeah. But, certainly the industry on the state level has evolved, incredibly rapidly over that time period. But I think we've seen a lot of productive movements on the federal level as well, part of which I think we'll talk about today with the CAOA.
Absolutely. All right, let's dive right in. Marijuana Moment reported Senate bill to federally legalize marijuana and promote social equity finally filed by Schumer, Booker, and Wyden. So the long-awaited Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act has finally been filed in the Senate. So some key changes since the initial introduction include increasing the allowable THC limit in hemp, the inclusion of a mandate to establish national impairment standards, and revised tax policies, which could benefit smaller businesses. So, David, how does this bill compare to the original draft? And do you think the changes that have been made are going to make it more appealing piece of legislation for the industry?
Yeah, and before I get into the specific changes, I want to focus on a keyword of the headline you just read for Marijuana Moment, and that is finally. This bill has been a very long time coming. The first conversation that the sponsors had about this bill was in February of 2021. They had a listening session with some stakeholders, some industry advocates, some criminal justice advocates, and they really sort of outlaid their plan for a larger comprehensive cannabis bill. We saw the discussion draft follow in June of that year. And then here we are, over a year later with the final bill introduced. There are a lot of substantive changes that occurred over that last year between this discussion draft and this draft. At least from a page number standpoint, the bill added about 150 pages worth of legislative content. Not all of that is necessarily deep substance. Some of it builds out on what type of study should happen, sets up some funding levels. But there are a number of changes that the authors made to this bill from stakeholder feedback. I believe the office has said that they got over 15,000 comments on their draft bill, of varying depth and detail, some certainly just single sentence thoughts about particular provisions or some very detailed complex analyses in terms of tax structure, in terms of permitting within the FDA. So a couple of changes that I wanted to highlight between the discussion draft and the current draft is they build out a 22-member advisory commission within the FDA. It's called the Cannabis Products Advisory Commission. And I think this is an area where we're going to see perhaps the biggest impact on existing state programs. What this commission is tasked with doing is setting limitations on potency, on packaging, on dosing, on serving sizes. So everything that you are thinking about with the typical medical industry on the state level is something that would now fall within the purview of this FDA body. So on that commission, they do reserve some spots for some industry representatives, both from the social equity community and then the industry at large. I'm reserving spots for cultivators, processors, wholesalers, or retailers. But this commission, I think, really will be acting as a sub-agency within the FDA when it comes to cannabis products. I think we have an analogous agency with the Center for Tobacco Products that's also housed within the FDA. Certainly that sort of subset and subdivision is responsible for some of the education campaigns we see with the Truth Initiative and looking at some of the advertising practices that the tobacco industry engages in. So I think that will be a very important body whenever it does get set up in the FDA. Other changes, as you mentioned, there is a definitional change for hemp, increasing the total dry weight of THC from 0.3% to 7%, 0.7% rather, total THC content. This is as a result of what we've seen since the Farm Bill in 2018 with a real proliferation of synthetic cannabinoids and hemp-derived intoxicating cannabinoids, Delta 8, Delta 10, the list goes on and on as we discover new ones each day. But there has been a growing concern both from the hemp industry and the cannabis industry that there are operators that are out there sort of subverting the intent of the original Farm Bill by producing intoxicating products intended for human consumption without necessarily having the same regulatory safeguards as you see for state legal cannabis. Other changes, again, there is a highway safety focus in this bill. They certainly outlined it in the discussion draft, but you see three really new areas where there is a lot more legislative language than what we saw last summer. The first is creating funding levels for cannabis impaired driving research. The second is directing the Department of Transportation to develop an education program, basically don't drive while high program. We've seen this similarly with alcohol in terms of education campaigns that they've come up. And I think the last most notable for highway safety is the Department of Transportation is required to develop a national impairment standard under this bill within 3 years of upon passage. Of course, where we sit right now is, I think, the ongoing concern with developing a national impairment standard is the lack of research available and the lack of methodology to develop something similar to the 0.08 standard we use with alcohol. There is provisions in the new draft of the new bill that allow for sort of an exception to this 3-year time window. It basically says that if the Secretary of the Department of Transportation can't gather sufficient research or there isn't sufficient research, they have a 2-year check-in period after that, every 2 years, to tell Congress why they have not yet developed a standard or at least what the state of research is. Pause there just for a second, but I think when we look at the criminal justice provisions of this bill, which I think is the real focus that Senator Booker and Senator Schumer originally introduced this bill, they are largely the same from what we saw in the original discussion draft. I think one exception is when they are looking in terms of facilitating social equity applicants entering into the space. The revised bill does create a lending program within the SBA. It is a 10-year pilot program, which would allow the Small Business Administration to make direct loans to cannabis businesses and to their intermediaries. That part is new, and it does focus more on the access to capital issues that we did not see in the first bill. But as far as the expungement language and the justice reform language, that is all very much the same. There are some small technical fixes, but it's very much still the spirit of the bill. So I'll stop there for some
questions. That was thorough. John, what did he miss? I know that your wheels are turning.
No, David, that was brilliant. And maybe, you know, maybe I'll approach it from a slightly different lens, which is less about what's in the bill and some of the potential implications based on the really elegant synopsis that David has given. So first is this idea of finally, and David, I love that you keyed on that piece, because this is potentially going to be a double-edged sword for the industry about, you know, a cautionary tale on being careful what you wish for. Yes, it is still too early to talk about whether this thing is going to pass or not. And David, I'd love your take on that. But now we have something on the table that is going to serve as a framework for the conversation around federal policy for cannabis. And this is going to have huge implications for the state businesses, the state level markets as we know them. The governance or the creation of an FDA body to govern cannabis products, one which I'm sure is going to draw a lot of lessons from our long history with alcohol and tobacco, and is going to be heavily influenced by both of those perspectives. Two, that is going to be looking at ways of normalizing all of the policies that have been developed at the state level. So they'll be looking at how things are being done currently at the state level. And three, one which is likely going to still be heavily influenced by stakeholders whose priority is going to be around minimizing harm, will likely mean that we're going to start seeing federal regulations that put far more constraints and constrictions on cannabis consumer products than we've seen at the state level. The idea of policy potency limits being a central anchor part of the mission of this group, and that's been a long-running debate at the state level, but broadly speaking, most states have said, you know, if you can make them and you can sell them, then so be it. So you may have potency caps of, in terms of bounding, for example, with edibles, you know, a single dose is 10 milligrams. But the idea of things like, you know, potentially caps on how potent concentrates might be, how potent a flower can be, could obviously potentially be immensely disruptive to state level markets. Things like labeling, you know, every time we've seen a state level market change its regulations around product labeling, operators have had to shell out a ton of money to retool their manufacturing process, retool their packaging processes to be in compliance with the new state regulations. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what the feds come out as the basic minimum requirements that the market's going to have to go into to retool around. Those are going to be relatively short-term issues, but at a time that folks are capital constrained, I'm sure there's a lot of small and mid-sized operators who aren't particularly interested or excited about having to make sweeping changes to the branding packaging at a critical time of building brand identity in this marketplace.
And I would add, it's not just on the packaging front where we'll see additional costs. You know, within this new development of CAOA, there's also language about, you know, the Occupational Safety and Health Act. So having your facility become OSHA compliant is going to be incredibly cost intensive if you're not already. You know, OSHA is not going to let businesses slide with, you know, faulty fire extinguishers, any workplace safety issues that come up in the traditional sense that they inspect, if they are now also going to be in the purview of looking at cannabis businesses. You know, certainly many states have put forth, you know, labor safety standards and worker safety standards within their regulations, but complying with, you know, OSHA is another level of expense for a lot of these businesses. And you know, as John mentioned, it may be a little bit of careful what you wish for when you're going to be so closely watched and closely regulated by the federal government, may find that the, you know, workflow that you have been operating in as a state licensed and authorized business may abruptly change.
And then maybe, and I love that point. And maybe one just kind of final quick thought, because there's so much here to unpack, but It's around the social justice piece. So the federal government is clearly going to take a proactive approach if this bill were to become law in records of expungement or in prison release and records of expungement for nonviolent offenders. There's going to be quite a lot of work done around that for federal level offenders. However, there's not going to be a great deal of power that the state, the feds are going to have on requiring states to do the same thing. So this is one of the areas where I think there's a possibility we'll end up seeing a left-right divide, where more liberal jurisdictions might move a little more quickly in both their legalization initiatives as well as their prohibition restructuring to address prisoner release, records expungement. But we've already begun to see some frothing and some disquiet from more conservative lawmakers that, you know, these people broke the law while it was still the law, and that shouldn't be something that gets erased. And so, you know, the even as the federal government may have some impact by addressing this at the federal level, it's going to be interesting to see how effective the feds are in trying to persuade reluctant states to adopt similar policies at the state level, which is where the bulk of these offenses are taking place.
Yeah, and it is structured under this bill as a grant program, both through something called the Community Reinvestment Grant Program, as well as the Equitable Licensing Grant Program. And you know, this is the Department of Justice saying, we're going to make money available for states that have made efforts to end some of the harms of the war on drugs, including expungement, but also including reentry services, job training, you know, making sure that there are low barriers to entry for new business applicants. But those grants are just grants. You know, they are not a mandate. They're not a directive. If there is a state that is going to be resistant to, you know, changing their cannabis laws, I don't think this is going to operate in the same way that, you know, the mandatory age of 21 for alcohol transpired. That is not actually a national age. It's incentivized through highway safety funding. Of course, it has become a national age because every state did not want to miss out on such a significant appropriation with their highway safety. But I'm not sure if that cannabis appropriation, at least for the first few years, will be significant enough to offset some conservative states in their interest to keep cannabis federally illegal.
And I think that's precisely the point. There's just not going to be enough capital in the pool, I think, to offset what continues to be pretty deeply rooted resistance in some of these jurisdictions.
Yeah. Well, David, from like the regulatory perspective, what sort of impact would CAOA have on the current regulatory frameworks in various states?
So one, I think, very welcome change from the original draft to the final bill is there is going to be a transition period as this FDA body gets built up and gets its members set and they start making rules through the rulemaking process. The transition period is going to allow existing state programs, particularly when it comes to edibles, to maintain the way they are right now. There's not going to be an abrupt halt on the passage of the CAOA. And I think this transition period is critical to make sure that the products that are currently on the marketplace aren't completely wiped out by a heavy-handed regulation from the FDA. You know, that was something that was missing from the original bill, that transition period. There was no indication that there was going to be, you know, any sort of on-ramp for the existing industry to adapt to federal regulations. So I think that is welcome. Where I see a problem already brewing with the way the CAOA presents regulation is it still doesn't clearly define a distinction between medical cannabis and adult use cannabis. As far as the federal government is concerned right now, all cannabis is illegal. What we've seen on the state level, though, is a difference of opinion and program in terms of what conditions qualify under medical programs, if it is a medical only program, and then within states, you know, the different paradigms of adult use and medical use. This is something that this bill doesn't really, I think, effectively contemplate, that there are these two tracks of cannabis regulation in states around the country. You know, even in, I think the most robust adult use markets like California, there's still a number of medical regulations, medical tax exemptions, benefits to being a medical producer only that don't exist when you are serving both the adult use and the medical industry. So the lack, I think, of intention with the differentiation between adult use and medical cannabis in the CAOA, I think is going to be a regulatory headache. Certainly they direct the FDA, the TGB, and a number of other agencies to develop regulations consistent with the CAOA. I think that is going to be an area where these regulations really show if a federal oversight of both medical and adult use cannabis is workable by the federal government.
John, anything to add to that?
Man, David is crushing it. I'm literally just slipstreaming in behind him. And actually, maybe a question for you, David. One thing that still feels a little bit unresolved to me is this idea of interstate commerce, which is obviously something that there's a lot of interest in the excess producer states. How do you think that plays out under a CAOE framework? Is it, do you think that we are, on the cusp of, assuming this goes through, on the cusp of finally being able to transport cannabis across consensual markets?
So I think we get probably 80% of the way there with CAOA. There's nothing in CAOA that says there's going to be a ban on interstate commerce or that it's going to be delayed. But you still have to get the states to cooperate. Certainly producer states, California, Oregon, Washington will be very eager to enter into a compact where they can export cannabis. There's a bill in New Jersey right now being led by the Senate president that is setting up a sort of tri-state area cannabis compact with New York, Connecticut. But you're going to have a lot of states, particularly, in the Midwest and likely on the East Coast, who are going to be very resistant to letting cannabis from other states come into their borders. They, were sold these programs saying that there'd be good tax revenue for the state, there'd be good job creation for the state, and allowing, a external marketplace to come in and sort of pull out the rug from under some of these, less established marketplaces. I think there's going to be some resistance in these state houses and these governor's offices. And that's not even, talking about how brands have just, established themselves, East Coast brands, West Coast brands. Certainly in New York right now, it is relatively easy to find a unlicensed vendor saying that they have, the finest California product. I think that will certainly change once the state's marketplace is fully operational. But, there's also a provision within New York's legislation that says they're going to provide a preference to New York producers, New York retailers, and New York residents within the program. So I don't think this is an area that the CAOA, fully contemplates the extent of. I think it permits it on its face, but I think there's a lot of other issues at the state level that need to be resolved before we see an open marketplace across state lines for cannabis products.
Yeah, totally agree with that. And I think there's a lot more excitement about the people who want to get it out of their state than the people who want to get it in.
Yeah. I mean, John, we had Graham from Glasshouse on our podcast recently, and, when you asked him, he's crushing in California. You asked him, are you going to expand into other markets? And he was like, no. Once it federally legalizes, the best cannabis in the country can get shipped everywhere. So it seems like that's on his mind, like you said, trying to get it out. So David, generally speaking, do you think cannabis can be regulated like alcohol or tobacco? So I know you mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, I think there's some lessons learned that we can take from both industries. And, the CAOA bill, I think, borrows on a lot of the anti-competitiveness language, the Tied House language that we see in three-tier alcohol distribution appears in the CAOA bill in terms of, limiting, or rather the prevention of limiting shelf space for any particular retailer. So that is a direct parallel that you see in the CAOA. Certainly how the tax structure is set up in CAOA borrows a lot from alcohol and tobacco as well. You are giving the Treasury Department sort of full discretion to enforce over tax permitting and tax stamping. And it's a concept that we see very much when you look at whether it's grain alcohol by the barrel or individual bottles. It's something that TTB has significant oversight for. I think where we meet a problem with pulling from regulations from alcohol and tobacco is the problem I addressed a few minutes earlier, is the medical versus adult use dichotomy. There is really no medical use for cigarettes or tobacco. And certainly in the modern pharmacy lexicon, there's no use for alcohol that's commercially available as well. Certainly there's rubbing alcohol and pure alcohol that's used for some disinfectants, but there's not really the same sort of crossover that you have with the cannabis market, where in many places being marketed as a therapeutic, and then in many other places being marketed as a recreational substance. So I think while there are areas when it comes to tax structures, when it comes to packaging and labeling, in terms of the labels appeal to children or lack thereof, there are parallels. But when you get into the issue of what does this product actually do for the user, that's where I think we don't have a great existing model, either with alcohol or tobacco products.
John, what are your thoughts on that?
So foundationally, there's, I think, some reasons why we would be a little bit concerned about trying to copy and paste regulations either from tobacco or from alcohol. So currently, and I don't think I'm out of turn in saying this, tobacco is really the only consumer product which is inherently designed to kill its consumers. Like, it's the only regulated product that we still have in a society that the science has converged around the idea that there's no health benefits to its use, and its use is almost guaranteed to kill you, which I think stands in sharp contrast to cannabis, where the science has been profoundly affirmative to its health and potential wellness benefits. Two, on the alcohol side, the science may have been kind of, at least the colloquial science for a long time has been, the Mediterraneans consume a glass of wine and that's why they're so healthy for a very long, for millennia, that's the story we've been hearing. But I was really struck by a paper that was put out by the Lancet, I guess it was in 2019, which was a global assessment of the health impact of cannabis on our global society. And there's a line at the conclusion of that report that read, the only safe amount of alcohol to consume is none, because in essence, there are no redeeming qualities to the use of alcohol. And indeed, there's been follow-up, there's a follow-up study that was released actually a few months ago that suggested, if we had the ability to do it, the healthcare community, the medical community, the epidemiologists were suggesting that ideally you would make alcohol inaccessible to 20 to 40 year old men, because that was the group that was at highest risk of abuse and highest risk of getting into trouble from their alcohol use. Both of these substances, both of these drugs, alcohol and tobacco, have had profound negative effects on our society, but we've accepted that regulation has been more effective than prohibition. And we've accepted socially some of the social costs that come with their regulation because they're so deeply interwoven into our social society. Cannabis, I think, unfortunately, because the stigma has so far preceded the science, has meant that we are in an environment where there's a lot of decisions around cannabis that are being informed by anecdote and reflex and old wives' tales, pardon the expression, than by real hard science. And part of the opportunity that we see here is with the march toward federal regulation is deep investment in sound, solid research that's not just looking for the harms, but looking for the potential benefits, and ready investment to capitalize on the potential therapeutic benefits of cannabis. Because if cannabis, if 93% of the consumers we survey say that their use of cannabis has significantly or slightly improved their health outcomes, Those are numbers that we cannot ignore, nor should we allow our concern about potential deleterious effects to some part of the population impede the progress toward significant investment in trying to understand how to harness the potentially profound therapeutic outcomes that cannabis can make possible. So, you know, I don't mean to suggest in saying all of that, that cannabis is purely safe. Clearly, there's some subsectors of consumers who face both psychological and physiological challenges if they consume or overconsume. But I think it would be a grave mistake to copy and paste regulations from either alcohol or tobacco to try and govern cannabis, because there's something about the way cannabis interacts with human psychology and human physiology that seems to improve one's health outcomes. And I think at a time that so many people around the world, not just in the US, are seeking non-habit-forming, non-addictive, non-side-effect-inducing therapeutics, cannabis seems to check a lot of the box for applications that are untapped and could have profound effect on improving human wellness.
Yeah, absolutely. David, how would you judge the bill's chances of success in the Senate?
So I think despite these improvements, it's still a bill that, it was described as the gold standard by Senator Booker. And I think what we have seen this Congress is Democrats putting out a bill that is their gold standard is not ultimately what gets passed through a very tight margin, but having only 50 votes. They put out, and I'll use the Inflation Reduction Act that just was signed into law as the most recent example. That is a far cry from the original plan of Build Back Better that they had introduced in terms of a lot of the climate and healthcare provisions that they wanted to get accomplished. So starting with the CAOA as the gold standard, at least in this political climate, makes me feel that it would have to be significantly changed, scaled down, compromised on to actually get it to the president's desk. I think the perception by the American public is Democrats have a majority in both chambers of Congress right now. Having 50 votes with the vice president being the tie-breaking vote is a far cry from having a true majority. Most pieces of legislation in the Senate, unless they use very specific policy tools like reconciliation, need 60 votes. And getting 10 Republicans on board with something this sweeping and this comprehensive seems incredibly unlikely. That's not to mention that there has already been resistance to the idea of federal legalization within the Democratic Party. Senator John Tester from Montana is on record saying that he doesn't support full legalization, as is Senator Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire. Having even just one Democrat be a no vote on the CAOA, greatly hurts its chances. I don't see a scenario where, even if you look at the states that are traditionally red states that have legal cannabis, whether medical or adult use, I have a hard time coming up with 10 senators, from those states, who would vote yes on such a sweeping bill. You may have the support of someone like Senator Murkowski from Alaska, who has been very outspoken on cannabis issues because it's been the will of her voters. You may have somebody like Senator Paul from a libertarian standpoint, interested in some of the personal freedom aspects of cannabis use. Looking at the size and scope of this bill, it just seems very unlikely that it, in its current form, would be able to get to the president's desk.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, Dave, maybe two quick kind of sub-questions under that. One, it sounds like Democrats in particular have been really animated by the Supreme Court decision around Roe v. Wade and then some of the wins that the Democratic caucus has had since. Do you see the shifting political climate, some of this building energy that certainly has been on the Democratic side, playing any role in the conversation around cannabis, even if it's not specifically around this bill? And then two, if not this, does the fact that this gets rejected increase the interest in or likelihood of something more narrowly targeted, safe banking, getting through in this coming cycle?
Yeah, and I'll start with the first question, and that it could potentially build support you know, as we go into the elections for the Democratic Party. Sure, but most of the conversations have centered around a idea that cannabis reform is going to happen in a lame duck Congress after the election has taken place. And I think this is largely because although this issue is incredibly, incredibly popular with the average American voter, you know, medical is polling at 91%. In the latest Gallup poll, adult use is you know, kneeling that 70% threshold mark. But, you know, it is not an issue that has really gotten the attention of a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Certainly having the majority leader of the Senate lead and introduce a cannabis bill, I think is an ideological shift to where we previously have been in other Congresses. But really it is a small group of members on Capitol Hill who really champion cannabis causes day in and day out, and has really made it one of the top issues for their voters in their district. There are so many other issues that I suspect that the Democratic Congress, as well as the administration, would like to act on in the very narrow window between now and Election Day, you know, including things like revisiting student debt, looking at Medicare drug pricing, you know, there are that they see as bigger issues that, you know, maybe cannabis would win them, you know, a couple of thousand votes, but wouldn't get the hundred of thousands of votes that they perceive that some of these other issues may. As far as the second question, in terms of whether this leads to something on a smaller scale, I think we're already seeing the results of that. So at the end of July, the Senate had a hearing for the first time about changing the federal status of cannabis. It was called decriminalizing cannabis at the federal level, steps we need to remediate the war on drugs. I may be paraphrasing that. But throughout that hearing, a narrative sort of emerged that small steps may not be the worst plan for cannabis reform, whether that's dealing with expungements at the federal level. At near the end of the hearing, safe banking came up. A few days after the hearing, Senator Booker said, you know, the gold standard quote, he's like, well, CAOA is the gold standard. Perhaps we should be looking to, and he used the phrase safe banking plus, the plus for him being elements of criminal justice reform, maybe some veterans access issues, maybe provisions that deal with the SBA. But, you know, even having the chief bill sponsor acknowledge that, you know, maybe his bill is aspirational and that he is looking for something that is more realistic to move forward, I think that makes it more likely for the end of the year. You know, you look at the fact that the House has already included the safe banking language in their National Defense Authorization Act. The Senate's expected to take up their version of the bill in the fall. You look at the fact that both chambers have passed a very comparable cannabis research bill, you know, with just a few phrases being different that will need to be conferenced before the end of next Congress. And you look at the support for some of these smaller, more incremental reforms, it seems far more likely from at least a prediction standpoint that a scaled down bill that maybe has elements of the CAOA, that has elements of safe banking, and then elements of some of these other proposals, maybe the more realistic pathway before a potential change in power pending the election results in November.
Well, David, as you remember, we hosted a very long 4-hour panel on the CAOA back in November. We had the pleasure of having you on for the FDA. So we basically covered all the topics that were in that session, except for one who I believe Safira Galoob was, we had the honor of her having moderating the session on international trade. So wanted to touch on that and how that plays into this this current bill that's out there. So John or David, you can jump in.
Within some of the tax sections, there's provisions about fair trade. And I think the office has got a lot of comments dealing with that some of the fair trade language within that bill may have an adverse impact on some of the state social equity programs. We didn't really see a change in language in the new bill, but the office did publicly acknowledge that they received some of these comments. And they said that, you know, these rules are fairly similar to what happens in terms of the regulation of malt beverages and wholesalers, and that to the extent that there would be any sort of fair trade practice violation or limitation, it would only apply if that limitation existed under state law. So they're giving a little bit of deference to the states on this. That doesn't necessarily answer your question on international, but I think as we look to Germany getting ready to potentially legalize adult use in the European Union, I suspect that many other member states of the EU are going to follow Germany's lead if they are successful. I think many folks in Europe are looking at Germany as sort of the, you know, the well-educated Colorado or California of the United States, having the lessons learned from both the states, but also some other international marketplaces. I don't see that there is going to be a lot of interest to import Canadian product, except for perhaps by the Canadian companies themselves. I think just from a marketing standpoint, you're going to see far more allusions to the state of California and the Emerald Triangle than you would for any Canadian cannabis. But once we have, I think, serious competitors in the EU and then Central America and South America continues to develop cannabis programs within their states, I think the international trade conversation becomes far different. But I don't know if we are quite there yet. I know the most recent cycle of the UN's meeting on narcotic drugs really resulted in no true policy changes for the global cannabis community. There have been, I think, a lot of efforts with that body to change at least the international scheduling status or to get update to some of the ways member states interface with the treaties when it comes to cannabis. But we haven't seen any real changes. We've seen a small recommendation a few years ago to move cannabis out of Schedule 4 internationally, which was the most restrictive schedule according to the treaties, but no real effort to make it widely commercially available.
All right, John, you're on the spot. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the international question faces the same challenges that the domestic import-export or domestic trade one faces, which is, are the very deeply invested operators like in the East Coast markets or in California going to be wanting to import Mexican or Colombian or Zimbabwean or Malawian cannabis? When on the Pacific states, they're sitting on more inventory that they can sell domestically, and on in the eastern coast markets, the operators have invested a huge amounts of money to get operational, but haven't yet recouped that investment. So I think the play, if it's permitted under federal law, will be to export American product into international markets. That's something that we haven't seen a lot of yet. And I think that's, there's going to be a lot of interest in particularly strong branded cannabis from famous American markets. The Emerald Triangle, I think, is going to do really well in places in Europe with savvy cannabis consumers. But the logistics of that are going to be pretty complicated. We've seen some interstate commerce already begin in places like, actually was speaking to somebody who's just done the first export of cannabis from Malta into Germany. So it's starting, but we are a pretty long way away from the European market looking anywhere close to the size, scale, and sophistication that we see in North America. The quantities being imported are going to be pretty small, and we certainly would not be advising any American producers to think they're going to build their fortunes selling into Europe over the immediate term. Those markets are still profoundly immature. The regulations are going to be pretty murky for a while, and they're going to be phenomenally competitive because we know that producers in Latin America, in Canada, and in parts of Asia and in Southern Africa are all planning on exporting to those markets. So it's a pretty crowded space with pretty limited demand. And I think it's going to be several more years before those markets have the capacity to absorb the volume of product that's being produced to target them.
Nice. Well, David, any kind of predictions or to look into your crystal ball about thoughts about federal cannabis policy in the next year or two?
Yeah. And so I think every election cycle we have changes the cannabis narrative in the right direction. Looking at this fall, we're going to have Maryland, Missouri, Arkansas, North and South Dakota all voting on adult use cannabis. While that may not immediately change their elected officials' position, having a new constituency that is voicing, you know, concerns of the industry and voicing concerns of the consumer has been traditionally helpful. You look at someone like Senator Kevin Cramer from North Dakota. You know, he was very anti-cannabis before his state originally voted for medical, then ultimately joined on safe banking, was vocal on some appropriations amendments, and you know, basically said, this was the will of my voters. I don't necessarily support it, but you know, this is what my state has moved forward with. So I think you see that shift, particularly with some Republican members. And I think the, you know, the race in Missouri is particularly notable. You know, Senator Blunt, who is on his way out retiring, he's a co-sponsor of Safe Banking. He's been pretty vocal about the growth of that industry in that state. So it should be interesting to see if his replacement picks up that mantle for a growing industry in that state. So I think any time that we have, you know, initiatives on an election cycle, it's impactful. And then, you know, even more so for on the specific candidate level, you look to somebody like John Fetterman in Pennsylvania, who has really taken the issue of cannabis legalization in full stride. He has made it part of his campaign platform. He has fundraised off of it. He has sold, you know, 420 stickers, Fetterman for Pottsylvania. It is done very well for him in that state, at least, you know, looking at the most recent polling numbers. So it is becoming an issue that candidates aren't afraid to embrace. I think for a long time, you looked at electoral politics and members were very reluctant to embrace something like cannabis on the campaign trail because they were worried of the critiques they would get from their opponents. I think that is dissipating a considerable bit. You are seeing less of the traditional reefer madness arguments. And instead, you're seeing, you know, arguments about potency and access by children instead of just, you know, outright cannabis is bad. So even that evolution where you have opponents thinking about very specific policy areas instead of, you know, completely ignoring the issue altogether, good evolution. As far as predictions, you know, I think something does get done this year. There is momentum from the CAOA. There's momentum behind safe banking. As I mentioned, both chambers have passed nearly identical research bills. And then a final note, in January, on January 1, the current directive for the Veterans Administration that says that they can talk about cannabis with their patients, but not necessarily fill out the recommendation papers, that's going to be expiring at the end of next year. And, you know, so that tees up sort of a conversation that at the very least that directive needs to be revisited. You know, it may be issued exactly the same as it currently is right now. But that, and then you look at the 2023 Farm Bill, hemp is certainly going to come up in conversations in early next year and early spring in terms of what we should be doing in terms of bolstering the hemp industry. So those are all very clearly identifiable metrics where we're going to have some sort of legislative vehicle that touches on cannabis or hemp. And it's just a question of what Congress wants to do with this.
Well, all good things. John, what do you think?
There's only one point I want to kind of pick up on what David has just said, which I think is, I actually pulled up the map to make sure I was looking at this correctly. So the polling for Maryland looks pretty good. I think, you know, there's been very, very strong support for cannabis in Maryland, particularly the closer you get to Washington, D.C. And so that's going to completely change the regulated landscape for regulated cannabis, given that you'll have D.C. and Maryland and Virginia surrounding D.C. as two legal jurisdictions. Two, if Fetterman were to win, and it looks like he's a couple of points ahead of Dr. Oz in their race for governorship, and if he pushes legalization in Pennsylvania through the legislature rather than trying to do this, I don't actually think they've got the ability to do this as a ballot initiative, then it would mean you know, potentially within the next 18 months, you might be able to drive from northern Maine to southern Virginia without having passing through a state where cannabis is not legal. That's you're driving through the most densely populated part of the American landscape. And I think the implications of that, the idea that you can drive for a full day through places where, you know, less than a year prior, they'd have thrown the book at you for having cannabis on you, is both illustrative of how quickly this is changing, and two, the inevitability of this being a question of when, not if. So if somebody who was a longtime Virginian, the thought of being able to do that kind of road kind of is kind of mind blowing, but we seem to be lurching toward then doing so at pace.
Amazing. Well, David, before we wrap, we give our guests the opportunity to give a shout out to someone in the industry. So the floor is yours.
No one's specific, but certainly all of the staffers on Capitol Hill who are working on cannabis issues. It is no one's primary portfolio. Know that they all handle a lot, you know, criminal justice, infrastructure, inflation, whole lot of issues. And so for the staff that is willing to give time on this issue, and to the drafters of the CAOA, hats off to you. We appreciate the work that you do, and we love to work with you on cannabis policy.
Amazing. Well, thank you guys both so much for your time. Thank you to our listeners. And again, please be sure to like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and share this episode. I am your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.